You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. And coming up on today's programme...
We are the fifth biggest economy in the world, the fifth largest exporter in the world, and the top destination for inward investment in Europe.
Not for much longer, though, warn EU business leaders. They confronted Theresa May about the realities of Brexit earlier today. We'll be speaking to one of them to learn what was said. Plus, we'll look at the continuing unravelling of the British government and brand Britain and how it looks to those waiting for answers across the world.
And I apologise. I apologise to Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe and her family if I have inadvertently caused them any further anguish.
We'll also hear how security and culture has changed in France 2 years on after the Bataclan attacks. And we hear about the legacy of art and design from the Soviet era.
Look at them. Posters which were created during the Civil War, and the image and the text worked together. And if you can't read... doesn't matter. The image tells you exactly what you need to know.
Plus, we get the Asian papers and what's happened to Britain's adverbs. And should we be frightfully rather or quite worried about it? That's all coming up in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. A powerful earthquake has killed hundreds of people on the northern border region between Iran and Iraq. Thousands more are believed to have been injured. One Iranian agency says that 70,000 people need shelter after the quake. The US President Donald Trump says he has a great relationship with his Philippine counterpart Rodrigo Duterte. Mr. Trump's comments come after the men met in Manila, but it's unclear whether the US leader raised the issue of human rights violations in the country, despite calls for him to do so. Global emissions of CO2 gases are projected to rise for the first time in 4 years. It's a blow to environmentalists who had hoped that a peak might soon be reached. The main cause of the expected growth has been greater use of coal in China, but researchers are uncertain if the rise in emissions is a one-off. And a team of underwater archaeologists believe they've found a cannonball from a Spanish ship that sank in a storm off the coast of Japan at the beginning of the 17th century. The vessel, which is called the San Francisco, was travelling from the Philippines to Mexico when it sank. Those are your headlines. A very warm welcome to Studio One. This is the Monocle Daily and I'm Emma Nelson. Europe's business leaders marched up Downing Street this morning to personally ask Britain's Prime Minister to get a move on with Brexit. We are now more than halfway between the date of the referendum last year and the day the UK officially leaves the EU. The voices from Europe are warning that not only is the UK more likely to suffer if it carries on in this way, but Europe itself is keen to move on. Well, joining me now from Brussels is Luisa Santos, who's Director for International Relations at Business Europe. And Luisa, you were part of the delegation seen striding purposefully down Downing Street this morning to call a meeting with the Prime Minister. Why did you decide to organise this meeting?
Well, actually, it was an initiative from Downing Street, so from the Prime Minister. But of course, we were very keen to be there because we believe indeed it's the right moment to pass the message of what the business, both in the Europe, continental Europe, but also in the UK, is expecting from these negotiations and why it is so important that we see progress at this stage.
You are not seeing progress. Is that the case?
Well, we just had in October the European Council saying that there is not enough progress to pass to stage two.
What was the tone like inside the meeting? One word that has been described is confrontational. Would you agree with that? What was said? What happened?
No, I don't think it was confrontational. I think that both sides expressed the views. The business community expressed the view that we are concerned, of course, because we are seeing more and more the possibility of a cliff edge. And that, of course, is very worrying because, big companies and multinationals might be already preparing with contingency plans. but we are basically worried about small and medium-sized companies that might not be fully aware of what the impact might be. So we express our concern, and from the other side, of course, Downing Street was, of course, constructively listening to what the business community was saying, also pointing out that, of course, they are expecting the European side to show some willingness to move. What for us is important right now, and I think this was the message we gave it very clearly, it's important that we have detailed positions, concrete positions from the UK government on the three issues that are important for the withdrawal. So the citizens' rights, the Ireland issue, and the financial settlement. And while we don't have that, of course, it will be difficult also to make the EU willing to move to phase two. I think this was the message we gave, and of course, this was also heard by Downing Street.
What happens if there is no deal?
Well, if there is no deal, we're going to have the worst-case situation for us, which means a cliff edge. It means that we go back to, well, WTO, but it means that we will have duties, we will have border checks, we will have different regulations, meaning that companies will have to produce products differently if they're going to go for the UK or the EU, possibly have different testing procedures, problems at the borders, of course, talking about air traffic, probably difficulties because we don't have the Open Skies Agreement. And there's a number of other agreements. Our agreements with third countries will not be valid anymore for the UK. So there's a number of consequences that basically will translate to complications, delays, and higher costs.
Finally, some people now say that the United Kingdom is becoming more and more irrelevant. Would you agree?
No, but it's critical that we do this process right. Right in the sense that we ensure that the UK economy is not so impacted. Of course, impact will have, but less impacted. If we don't have any deal at all, well, of course, the economic impact will be higher. And of course, this will have also political consequences.
Luisa Santos, Director for International Relations at Business Europe. Thank you very much. Joining us in the studio now is Sean Kemp, former special advisor to the Liberal Democrats and someone very familiar with what goes on in the corridors of power. Welcome back to the studio, Sean. Just listen to what Luisa was saying there. She's talking an awful lot about cliff edges. And I wonder whether the United Kingdom is not just on a cliff edge when it comes to Brexit, but combined with the way that, for example, the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has handled the treatment of a British woman being held in Iranian jail at the moment, whether we're on a cliff edge of a slightly bigger nature as a nation.
Well, I don't know if it's a cliff edge or if it's just the inevitable sort of stage of what's been kind of a slow decline of Britain's sort of position in the world. And that sounds massively dramatic, but for a relatively small country, we have for a very long time been at one point the most powerful country in the world, and then even up to and after World War II, incredibly sort of important and influential, retained that via the EU, and to an extent that sort of role as a bridge between Europe and America. And now I think as a country we're slowly starting to face up with what it means when you are just a country sort of on your own, you're outside of a big European bloc. Many of the people who sort of argue for Brexit kind of talk about going back to the days of the Commonwealth and so on. But that's, I mean, in reality, what's actually happening is Britain is kind of moving to being roughly the kind of country that is in a world on the world stage, is a sort of mid-sized country on the fringes of Europe.
Well,
that's what we are.
Possibly not what the Brexiteers would say. They would say that actually that having been shackled by this enormous EU bloc around the ankles, dragging them down underwater for so long, the United Kingdom can regain its position, or indeed forge, more importantly, a new position in the world, nimble, athletic, and perhaps going back to the agility that an old United Kingdom had before.
Yes, I mean,
I never thought I'd give a post-Brexit question on Monocle 24.
I think you should be careful of just completely dismissing that, because is it possible to be a country that's removed from some of the regulations, and if you regard them as regulatory burdens, let's sort of look at them that way, and say, OK, we're going to be a kind of free trading nation, we're going to be very light on the red tape, whatever that may mean. That would be very ironic, obviously, because a lot of the people who voted Brexit are working class people, are pretty protected by red tape. Is there a potential of doing that? Yes. The difficulty is that a lot of the Brexiteers, not all of them by any means, but a lot of the people who sort of dress it up as let's go back to those old days of us being a nimble trading nation. We did a lot of that trading thanks to gunboats. It wasn't just because of our brilliance as a sort of trading nation. We did it partly by military power, partly because of the Industrial Revolution, a million and one reasons. And there's a dangerous nostalgia, I think, in terms of how we want to describe what kind of nation we're going to be. We tend to hear a lot of sort of quite utopian descriptions of what Britain will be like after Brexit that often seem to bear a lot of relation to what people think we were like 100 years ago. It's not necessarily kind of forward-looking, what kind of nation are we going to be vision. And I'm not sure people really know. It's the great power of Brexit was it's this kind of shining city on a hill, and no one could quite say what it was, but it was some kind of hope. I know it sounds daft to say that, but it was. It represented, okay, it's something new. And now we're actually getting closer and closer to wanting to know what that something is. And it's starting to look more and more worrying.
Well, I wonder whether this is the key problem of Britain's lacking of lessening relevance in the world, that if, for example, Brexit were in a safe pair of hands, we might not feel so desperate in so many ways. But what is happening in front of our eyes is a government that is beating itself up and can't even decide what its Brexit wants to look like, where we have the European business leaders saying, well, we're all sorted. There's 27 member states. We have contingency plans that will fire from April. We know what we're doing. Our ducks are in a row. Come on, UK. You're a mess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to put two health warnings in here. One is that I don't think actually Britain declining importance is necessarily a bad thing. It's not a bad thing just to be at what your natural level is in the world. And there's nothing necessarily wrong in that. The other is I do think people like myself who are pro-Remain can be inclined to believe everything the other 27 nations say and want to always instantly dismiss what our own negotiators say when they say, look, it's not as bad as it sounds. And there is always a loss of sound and fear in these negotiations. So I do think we have to put some health warnings on this. The difficulty with trying to put the positive spin on the Brexit negotiations, though, is to the layperson, you look at the state of the British government, which is a phenomenal mess. There's no two ways about that. And it's very hard to believe a government which at the moment does not look like a functioning government can really be on top of possibly the most complex negotiation in our country's modern history. So there is, you are required to make a little bit of a leap of faith. Now, I might be proved to be wrong, but I don't like being in the position of like being required to make that leap of faith. And that's where people are at the moment, because the Conservative government led by Theresa May is in a bit of a mess. They're going to be able to hang on to power for as long as they like, but there's a sense of a lack of direction, a sense of a lack of discipline, and none of these things are conducive to a good unified negotiation
position. So how do we unpick this, given what seems to be now pretty much inevitable fact of Brexit, that it's going to be really hard for this to stop? The only thing that seems to be a potential way out is to actually have strong leadership when it comes to the United Kingdom. We've just established that is not the case. I mean, I know it sounds daft, but I watched the Paddington film yesterday. My goodness, the United Kingdom looked absolutely lovely there. There was a softness and a gentleness and a soft power there. The United Kingdom, you know, bear in red hats notwithstanding, the United Kingdom has in the past had extremely influential soft power. It ranks extremely highly in the monocle ratings each year. Can we not keep our relevance that way?
Yes, I think for Britain to be a relevant nation, I think a nation that punches above its weight, it's probably going to be more in the cultural soft power sphere. I've got no sort of doubt about that. And I don't think Britain's about to lose all of its cultural relevance like overnight at all. The other sort of great weapon I think that Britain does have as well is do not underestimate the ability of Britain throughout its history to somehow muddle through. That's kind of what we do better than anything else. We kind of muddle through sticky situations and we do it quite well. And it's one of our sort of strengths. We kind of find a kind of middle ground through difficult. So there is a kind of a sort of my hope as a Remainer who completely accepts we are leaving the EU is that actually at the end of the day, we'll sort of find a sort of bit of a fudge that all kind of get us through and it won't be as apocalyptic as everybody imagines. I'm aware I sound quite naive to some people, but at the same time, it's kind of what our strength is. And what we don't actually want is some mad, strong ideological leader. We just want to fudge a deal. We just want something that keeps the good bits of EU trade and doesn't completely cripple us in terms of what we can do internationally and then build from that.
And if you were sitting in Downing Street, which is where you have done in the past now, would you be saying, tell them that you're muddling through? Briefly.
No, you can't. And that's the great problem for the government is that they have to provide, they have to not say anything that's going on in negotiations because they have to keep it secret. At the same time, they have to give everybody confidence, including cynical people like us. And at the same time, they don't have much of a majority and are all fighting. That is a pretty difficult hand to be dealt with.
Sean Kemp, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, as we've just been hearing, as one nation scrambles away from Europe, many of the remaining EU member states signed a pact today that brings ever closer union on the battlefield. 20 nations have signed PESCO, the Permanent Structured Cooperation. Its purpose, to create a closer way of working when it comes to troops and weapons. Well, joining us now is Ryan Heath, senior EU correspondent at Politico. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Ryan. So the assumption is, therefore, that the European Union member states were not that unified before this treaty was signed.
Well, that's right. And the UK has obviously been quite critical in holding the EU back from doing anything that resembled a defence union. So what happened today is pretty much a big win for Federica Mogherini, the chief diplomat of the EU, and it's a win for the German perspective over the French perspective. Now, both those two big countries were keen that some kind of defence cooperation occur, but the Germans wanted to include as many people as possible, and the French wanted to keep it really to the major countries, the military nations of Europe, and the Germans carried the day, and it was clearly a very large majority are willing to sign up to this.
Indeed, the German defence minister said, we see that nobody will resolve the security problems Europe faces in its neighbouring countries for us. Has there been too much of a reliance on the United States through NATO?
I think that is a fair assessment, and I think that's a point that three successive US administrations have pushed. Donald Trump has made a much bigger fuss about it, but for a long time now, the US has essentially said, own way. Now, there are complicated constellations at play here, where not all EU countries are in NATO. There are obviously other countries outside of the EU that are also in NATO. And there's a third constellation now, which is the ones that have actually signed up to this enhanced cooperation. But the point is that you're seeing more cooperation between all of those entities and a greater realization, one that Europe in general needs to do more on the military front, given the threats that come from migration to the south, Russia to the north and the east, and just generally that the US isn't going to be there to save the day.
Will it make Europe safer then, this pact?
I think in the long term, yes, because the EU has limited resources. Obviously, one of those big resources is paying people to be a standing army, navy, etc. And people get paid a lot more than they used to. So that's an expensive thing to do. So you have to do things like joint procurement. You also, when you face big threats, whether it's Russia, whether it's the instability coming out of North Korea, you have to actually coordinate all of your weapons as well. And people are going to be on the track to do that now in a way that they haven't previously.
And finally, very briefly, Ryan, that some member states didn't sign. Poland was a last-minute signatory, but the likes of Portugal, Malta, Ireland decided not to. Is that a fly in the ointment at all?
It's not ideal, but I think Ireland was probably never going to sign. Ireland has been historically a neutral nation while it's been a republic, so it's not surprising that that has occurred. I think people will expect Malta and Portugal to sign up at the end of the day, and Denmark, like the UK, is one of those countries that has a lot of opt-outs out of EU system. So I think it's a sign of them holding a general principle they don't want to get too close to the EU, rather than that there's a special problem with this defence arrangement.
Ryan Heath from Politico, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It is 2 years since 130 people died in a series of coordinated terror attacks across Paris. Today, the city's mayor, Anne Hidalgo, was joined by France's President Emmanuel Macron to lay wreaths near to the scene of one of the shootings. Although time has moved on, France remains in a state of high security alert. Well, Florence Biedermann is the London Bureau Chief for AFP. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Florence. Time has moved on, but France still feels very much under the shadow of threats, both from externally, from the outside world, but also internally.
Yeah, internally, certainly. There was still, after this horrible attack, there was still a series of smaller attacks, but still it maintains a feeling that something is always possible, that people will still try to commit attacks. And also, there is the kind of perceived threat that the jihadists who are leaving now Syria or Iraq, or the French jihadists, for example, who would like to come back, may still be a threat. That's what maintains this atmosphere. That was even described by the Interior Minister as a war.
This is astonishing because Laurent Nunez, who's the head of the French Internal Intelligence Agency, gave an interview to Le Figaro. I mean, this doesn't happen. The spies do not talk to the press, especially.
Maybe he's not the real spy. Maybe there is a spy behind him.
He's the one with the desk. So he's ostensibly the head of it. And he's saying is that plans for terrorist attacks prepared by teams who are still operating in fighting zones in Syria and Iraq are what really, really worry them at the moment.
Well, still, I mean, it seems that they have less and less space there, I mean, to plan that kind of attack. I mean, since they have been practically rooted out. Okay, there are still maybe some uncontrolled zones, but certainly they don't have the facilities that they had before. They may not have also the money, like they had some oil revenues, and this is really over. So the threat may not be as concentrating on some geographical area, but definitely it still exists.
Let's just count ourselves, go back to 2 years ago politically. Emmanuel Macron's party En Marche didn't even exist when the Bataclan attacks took place, and it was him today who was laying the wreaths with Anne Hidalgo. Is there any sign that he has got a grip on the situation? It was a situation that François Hollande tried very hard to take control of in the dying days of his presidency, ramping up the security situation more and more and more. And Emmanuel Macron is being criticised for sort of saying on the one hand and on the other hand, striking that balance between security and freedom. Is there any sign that he's got anywhere with it?
Well, he has also been criticised because he introduced a very harsh anti-terror law that has been highly criticised by liberals and extreme left, and that have grossly been accepted by the population again because of this perceived threat. But there is still the army in the streets, so I would say he's really in the continuity of Hollande's policy. By the way, for all other aspects he refutes. I mean, he tries to be very different from his predecessor, but on this aspect he certainly is in the continuity.
Why do you think that is?
Because that may be one of the aspects in Hollande's presidency that were, let's say, successful. Maybe it's a terrible word, but the way he managed after the attacks, the kind of empathy he showed, I mean, the kind of dignity he brought was certainly among the best moments of his presidency. And also the intervention in Mali to fight jihadists there had a popular support. So definitely there is one aspect in Hollande's presidency where obviously he was, or he seemed for the population to be in control, that was after these attacks, even if he didn't prevent other attacks, obviously.
Cities and indeed countries are very resilient creatures. You look at what happened in London, people bounce back the day after an attack. And indeed, if you go to Paris recently, the atmosphere there is so different to what it was 2 years ago. There's not just a sort of a feeling of recovery, but there's a feeling of resilience. You know, good things are happening to the cities. You know, they've got a new president, they've got the Olympics coming in a few years' time. But nonetheless, there is, as you say, that feeling that, you know, the army is still on the streets. There is, you go into buildings and it says, OK, we are still on a high security sense of alert. Have the French become accustomed to feeling under threat?
I don't know. What I feel is under, yes, this surface of resilience, but still, I mean, the people have been deeply shocked. I mean, it's. I think it stays inside. I mean, it's something that won't be at the surface all the time, but the trauma is still there. So, of course, life goes on. As you said, it was also the same in London, and it's also a way to fight against terrorism, like to tell to the people who perpetrate these attacks, we won't change, we will still be as free as ever, we will still go and have drinks in the evening and enjoy music. But, I mean, there is still this kind of hurt, deep wound, I would say, which stays. I mean, you talk to the people, I mean, everybody remembers, what was I doing on that night? They know a friend of a friend who knows someone, so it's still something really strongly felt.
When you look at France, consider France and the way that it deals with immigrants and immigration and people who are not from France, of first and second generation, it is a problem that many people have said exists and isn't addressed. Do you think that France is more accepting, or indeed has become less accepting, of immigrants and people who aren't traditionally French, the kind of people that Marine Le Pen decided to victimise so much during her campaign? What I think I'm trying to say is France any more or less racist than it has been as a result of these things?
I think you had the answers in the vote for the presidency. I think you had the answer also with Brexit. I mean, I think it was a largely shared phenomenon in Europe that this migrants wave during the summer some years ago has also had an impact. I mean, obviously, so I'm not going to say the French are better or worse, but definitely also these attacks and the whole story has not conduced the people to be more tolerant. I wouldn't say that.
Florence Biedermann from AFP, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. A fourth woman has now come forward to claim she was sexually assaulted by the Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore. Mr. Moore has been asked by several of his own party to quit the race. The trouble is, they all say he can't. Well, Ed Stocker is our New York Bureau Chief and he joins us on the line now. Ed, welcome back. These latest allegations by a waitress, Beverly Young Nelson, they add to what, 3 pre-existing claims against Roy Moore?
There's a whole string of accusations, exactly, with people ranging from 14 to 18. The most serious, obviously, the 14-year-old being a minor at the time. These relate to Roy Moore when he was obviously much younger in his career, when he was in his 30s, in the late 1970s and early 80s. Obviously, he's gone on to sort of carve out quite a flamboyant and one might even say a fundamentalist career. He was twice removed from the state's high court for once failing to remove the Ten Commandments from the Supreme Court and then also refusing to accept gay marriage. He is, of course, a lawyer and standing currently, anyway, in the December the 12th election for the Senate seat that was vacated by Jeff Sessions. Obviously now a growing chorus of people calling him to step aside, and most important of that, of course, is the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who actually said those words. He said he should step aside. He also said that he believed the women and their accounts, which is, you know, in a way unprecedented, because these are still allegations that one might argue haven't been proven. So the fact that Mitch McConnell is coming and saying these things are, A, perhaps a sign of the times, given the slew of sexual misconduct cases we've had kind of kicked off by Harvey Weinstein, and also possibly the fact that Roy Moore wasn't exactly the favoured establishment candidate. That was Luther Strange. He actually lost out to Roy Moore in the primary for that Alabama race. Luther Strange had been endorsed by the likes of Mitch McConnell and even Donald Trump, who later backtracked. But Roy Moore, with his particular style, kind of the sign of this new Republican Party, endorsed by the likes of Stephen Bannon. So you could say that perhaps Mitch McConnell would be happy for a figure like Moore, who is arguably divisive for the Republican Party, to have to step aside.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it, when you think about it in that way, Ed? Because just because someone has made some unpleasant comments in the past and has a reputation for not saying nice things, it does not mean that as soon as an accusation or four arrive of sexual inappropriate behaviour, that should be used as that should immediately be assumed that he's guilty of it. But it does split the Republicans, doesn't it? Because it forces people to make political choices as opposed to just taking the facts or the allegations as they are.
Indeed, and I think, like I was saying before, I think that it is sparked by all the headlines that we have about this sort of conduct that have been making headlines not just in the US but worldwide. I think we really will have to see whether he does decide to step aside, you know, if he does heed these calls. But he is a kind of insurgent. He is, someone who doesn't go quietly into the night. He's already said that he intends to sue the Washington Post, which is the newspaper that broke the original allegations interviewing four women. And then today, obviously, another testimony has come to light, and a news conference was held earlier today in New York City. He's not seeming to go away, and what we'll have to wait and see is if he actually continues to stay in this race for December the 12th. Then, you know, there's a suggestion that amongst a lot of Republicans, they'd still vote for him. I mean, if that tide doesn't change, imagine a scenario where he actually wins that election, then that Senate would have to make a decision about whether they expel him. I mean, it plays well for two people. It plays well for Doug Jones, who's a Democrat, who could win, although it still seems unlikely in a state that hasn't elected a senator from the Democratic Party in 25 years. It also plays well for a possible write-in candidate. That's if the Republican Party can get behind one other rival candidate, as it were, and when people vote, they have an option to write someone's name on the ballot that isn't the official candidate. It's happened in the past before. People have won, only a few. But we'll have to see if there's a move, which Mitch McConnell entertained today, that they might go for this write-in candidate as a rival to Moore if he decides that he can weather this storm and he won't step aside before December the 12th.
Ed Stockett in New York, thank you for joining us. Soviet Russia relied heavily on propaganda and, unsurprisingly, as a result, it had a very strong design culture. The state encouraged and funded artists, photographers and architects to direct their energy towards a greater communist cause. Well, now an exhibition at London's Tate Modern Gallery gathers some of the most striking artefacts of Soviet society's visual culture under one roof. And Mariana Lagrasta paid a visit.
David King was the arts director of the Sunday Times in the 1970s. And for the anniversary of Leon Trotsky, he was asked to put together a special illustrated supplement on Leon Trotsky. He started looking for images and, to his astonishment, couldn't find any. So he was sent by his director on a research trip to the Soviet Union. And you can imagine, David King, 1970s, middle of the winter, he steps off the plane in the middle of Moscow and asks, where can I find the images of Leon Trotsky? And Leon Trotsky was an absolute persona non grata, the commissar who was completely erased, brushed out of any historical background in Russia and the Soviet Union because of the disagreement he had with Stalin. So you can imagine what the reaction was to this very simple request. So So he had to go back empty-handed. And this is how his quest, first for the vanished commissar, Leon Trotsky, and then later for this incredible visual culture he witnessed in Russia and in Moscow around this time, started.
The political events of the October Revolution gave way to a deep social transformation in Russia. A new ideology, communism, inspired innovation in arts and graphic design across the country.
Imagine 100 years ago, you live in the country where level of literacy is less than 20%, that most of the population received personal freedom just a few years ago, when most of the population are peasants without rights to vote, without any social rights. And then someone comes with the idea of equality, with the idea of the power in the hands of the working class, with the idea of emancipation for women. So the artist got really inspired by the idea of social equality, by the idea of the social state, the communist state in the future. And the artists who were instrumental in the Russian avant-garde movement of a pre-revolutionary period either immigrated, left Russia, or decided to work with the new power, with the new government, and give this new government, give this new state, a new social order, visual identity. And this is what they started working on. And this is why most of them, artists like Alexander Rodchenko, or L. Lisitsky, or Alexander Daynecker, they abandoned easel painting. They abandoned creating single artworks which could be hung on the wall of the salon or a museum, and started working on the works which were accessible for millions. On the posters, you put the poster on the wall, it's visible for thousands of people who pass this wall. On books, you publish a book, the edition of hundreds of thousands. You publish a magazine, the same situation. Postcard, also very, very popular new medium. And this is how the messages were spread, how the new visual culture aiming at creation of a new man, an environment for the new man, for the new society began.
Today, we still feel the impact of the innovations brought about by the artistic revolution of 1917. Many graphic designers in the UK grew up on the images David King created. King himself wanted the visual culture of the former Soviet Union on public display and for everyone to see and be inspired, just as it inspired his work.
It's very urgent and important to have this exhibition on show today and now. We all have mobile phones, we all have pages on Facebook, we all have friends following us on Instagram, we all have Twitter accounts. Guess what? It wasn't invented now. Those kind of messages, the idea of people following, the idea of mass communication, visual culture which helps to spread the message, was invented in the Soviet Union, in Russia, around the time of revolution, civil war. And it was absolutely crucial that the artists, poets, writers, performers all join in.
Do you have a favorite piece in the exhibition?
Yes, absolutely. And it's my favorite piece because it's a bit of a mystery and a bit of a discovery. In the 1931, two Hungarian intellectuals, Sándor Márai and László Domondi, got together in order to put a photo book, something we're all familiar with now, but it was absolutely cutting-edge innovation in the 1930s, in the 1920s as well. And they decided that this photo book will be on Russian history, and it will describe Russian history very visually through photographs from the mid-19th century until 1932, the year of industrialization of the Soviet Union. And they put the mock-up for the book together, but it's never been published. It was always a mystery. And David King heard about this book, and he was scouting the world looking for the mock-up, and he found it in the Dutch publishing house in the walls of a Dutch publishing house in the 1970s, and he acquired it for his collection. And this is what we are very fortunate to show our visitors today.
An exhibition for all ages. Red Star Over Russia shows how communism changed a nation, visually, socially and politically. For Monocle in London, I'm Mirjana Lagrasta.
Thank you, Mirjana Lagrasta. And that exhibition is on at London's Tate Modern now. And you can hear more on design by listening to Section D, Monocle's programme all about design. It airs tomorrow at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. The archive is at monocle.com. Coming up, though, we review the Asian papers. Stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world. Join us for Sunday brunch on Monocle 24. Feast on some foodie tips from those in the know. Tuck into behind-the-scenes tours of offbeat events in your city and sample our radio team talking about their favourite records. All that before a huge helping of broadsheets from around the world. Wherever in the world you are, Sunday brunch is a brimful buffet of radio, the perfect soundtrack to your weekend. So don't miss out. Join us for brunch live every Sunday between 10 and 11 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24.
The time is 6:42 a.m. if you're listening in Beijing, 22:42 here in London. It's time for a check of some of the big stories in Asia. I'm delighted to say that Agata Kratz, who's Associate Policy Fellow for the Asia and China programme at the European Council on Foreign Relations, joins me. Your name, job title doesn't get shorter each time you come in, does it? Luckily, you've gone for some neat, snappy writing when it comes to what you found in the newspapers. Let's have a look at what you first decided to bring into us. The focus remains on Myanmar, doesn't it? And it's being talked about quite a lot, well, very prominently in the South China Morning Post.
Yeah, so it's more of a follow-up story than a new development. The one new development that brings in the this topic in the South China Morning Post is the fact that the general that was in charge of the Rakhine State and Rakhine State military operations has been demoted. No reason has been given for that, and no more information has been given about what happened there. But a few rumors are going around that it might be because Rex Tillerson is due to come to the country on Wednesday might be addressing a strong signal to the military at this occasion and to generals in the military. And so that might be one first sign or one way for Myanmar to signal that they understand what's going to come there on Wednesday.
Well, just the demotion, although I don't think he has been demoted, has he? He's just been moved.
Yeah, exactly.
So this isn't a demotion of the person who, of the one individual.
He's been moved from his post.
He's been moved from his post. That does not, by any stretch of the imagination, address the terrible catastrophe that seems to be happening. But they are doing this in the hope that what? That people actually think, well, it's all going to change, just the removal of one person.
Simply sending a signal that, you won't have the person that was in charge actually meeting with Rex Tillerson when he does come to the country. Just saying, we're maybe rethinking the strategy or maybe have heard the criticism from outside enough. Maybe thinking of taking another point of view to solving the issue in the Rakhine State. I have no idea. I mean, no one's been given information about why this move has been happening. But this is only what we can read through the lines.
It is unusual, and the article goes on to just repeat the degree of violence that has been meted out against the Rohingya.
Yeah, absolutely. And
the fact that it is just reiterated time and time again. A senior UN official has described the army's actions in Rakhine State as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. I mean, when Rex Tillerson does arrive in the next few days, few weeks, What is expected to happen then? I mean, are we to expect him to stand up and start to make some calls for change? This becomes as much of a test on Rex Tillerson that it does, just as it does on Myanmar.
I think there's no doubt that there's going to be some mentioning of the Rakhine situation, and that there's going to be strong yet diplomatic criticism of what's happening. The one issue is that, well, there hasn't been much done at the UN on the issue, and what you want to do is, besides talking, is actually being able to put that in action. And unless you have the contact of the UN to help enable you to, you know, raise kind of multilateral sanction on the country, that's a little bit tough. The other thing that the article points to is the fact that the ASEAN, which was meeting over the weekend, did not mention the Rohingyas, the Rohingya situation in their final statement, and that despite Malaysia and Indonesia having been quite active in trying to raise the issue at the ASEAN level, at the international level. But the ASEAN is first and foremost a consensus-based forum, and Myanmar being part of it means that this couldn't really be put into the statement. And besides, it's an association based on the principle of non-intervention and foreign country sovereignty. So it's something that they would be really reluctant to do anyway.
Okay, let us move on to the quite frankly bizarre pictures that we've been seeing in the last couple of days of Donald Trump and Rodrigo Duterte's meeting in Manila. Philippines Duterte sings love song for Trump, "You Are the Light." I mean, this is a surprise turn at a summit dinner in Manila, says the Guardian out of Manchester, explaining it was ordered by the US leader. All of this just sounds so deeply, deeply strange. It is just, this is an astonishing thing. It says, President Rodrigo Duterte crooned a hit Filipino love song at a dinner in Manila for leaders from Asia, explaining later that it was on the order of Donald Trump. Again, it's that indication that, what do we think of Trump's arrival and Trump's trip so far to Asia?
I think as far as Trump goes, it went pretty well. But I think as far as Trump goes, it went with all of the contradiction that you'd expect around the Trump visit. As we just said, Rex Tillerson is on his way to Myanmar to try and make a point about human rights abuses in Myanmar. Yet, of course, Trump meets with Duterte and is happy to shake his hand and have a kind of lively, lovely conversation with him. So that's one contrast. The other contrast I would like to point out, and you're actually, I think it's our next item, is the fact that Trump is also meeting with the leaders of the democratic world or democratic Asia to a certain extent, trying to launch what might be the new pivot to Asia, which is the Indo-Pacific, strategy. And within this, a rapprochement between Australia, India, Japan, and China, the US, as a, you know, without it being said clearly, as a way to counter China, of course.
It is. It says, India's external affairs ministry said in a statement after this meeting among America, Japan, India and Australia, that a free, open, prosperous and inclusive Indo-Pacific region serves the long-term interests of all countries in the region and of the world at large. When you mean long-term interests of all countries, how much do you read China in that?
Yeah, exactly. I think the one thing that is being pointed to very clearly is the fact that, the four countries have in common the fact that they're democratic. The four countries have in common the fact that they have had either skirmishes or territorial issues, at least for Japan and for India with China. Australia being a little bit the reluctant player in the picture, because already in 2008 it was the one that had stopped the quadrilateral meeting between the four countries. But anyway, some kind of a principled but also Asian-based plus US teaming up against China.
And an alliance now between the United States and India, according to this article, and yep, not least because of the really odd cuddle that seem to be happening between Narendra Modi and Donald Trump. It's so strange because Narendra Modi is clearly significantly smaller than Donald Trump and fits under his armpit when he went in for the embrace, and so it has a sort of parental look to it. But you know, that's sort of slightly belittling the fact that America and India, in terms of defence, are getting quite strong together.
They're getting strong together. They're getting much closer in many respects. I think Rex Tillerson once again was explaining that the US was looking towards just building a much stronger strategic partnership with India over the next decade. And I think, you know, that's part of the new strategy that might be emerging finally from the US administration on Asia.
Right. China's gone shopping, Agatha.
Yeah, absolutely.
Singles Day is something that we've spoken about pretty much every year for a few years here on Monocle 24. But for those of us not acquainted with the Chinese Singles Day and basically why it's an excuse for everybody to go and spend money, just tell us what's happened.
So Single Days, if you haven't thought about it, is takes place on the 11th, so 1111, which is, well, you know, single people being single, but indulging themselves and by going online and shopping for tons of and pretty much anything you can find on the internet. And that's a day of shopping, pretty much like Black Friday in the US. It's been created in 2009 by Alibaba, which is which is China's e-commerce leader, to just, you know, create a one big day buying spree. And it's turned into a huge competition. Alibaba, I think, didn't know that it was going to be both a blessing in disguise, but also a big challenge for it, because all of the other, e-commerce platforms and websites have actually just, you know, jumped on the bandwagon and decided that they also want to be part of Single Day. And this year was a typical one, because JD, which is Alibaba's main competitor, announced before Alibaba that it had reached the 100 billion yuan threshold, although over 10 days rather than one day, as Alibaba did. But this pissed off Alibaba's management very clearly, who made a statement saying that they weren't counting on the same basis and that definitely JD was bad at math.
And this nasty spat highlights just how ferocious the fight is to conquer the world's fastest online market. The Chinese
Absolutely.
Are going crazy for shopping online.
Exactly. I mean, the sheer number is just already on China's side. If you have close to 1 billion people using their phone and using their phone to actually buy things online, you have the biggest e-commerce market in the whole world. But on top of that, it's a population that has a growing, year after year, growing income, growing purchasing power. So you've got yourself, even if you get a small share of the pie, you've got yourself a huge market and a huge potential. And what the event marks every day is indeed potential, because every year what people look at more than the number and the value is actually the growth over the last year. And this year, for example, Alibaba grew 39% compared to 2016, its sales grew 39% compared to JD, 50%. So JD is maybe indeed the winner of this Singles Day.
Agatha Kratz, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24.
Thank you.
Finally, as if our Brexit economic and cultural woes were not bad enough, a recent study from the linguistics professor Paul Baker at Lancaster University suggests that gradable adverbs, come on, you must know what those are, rather, quite, awfully, are dying out as part of the English language. Well, early on Midori House, Monocle's awfully good editor, Andrew Tuck, spoke to the rather brilliant journalist and outstanding commentator Terry Stiasny and quite brilliant Alessio Patilano about it.
Do you think we might have that down a bit, darling? Hi, Laura.
Yes, dear?
If you were miles away.
Was I? Yes, I suppose I was.
Do you mind if we turn that down a little? It really is deafening.
Of course not.
Shan't be long over this, darling, then we'll go off to bed.
If look a bit tired, you know.
Don't hurry, I'm perfectly happy.
A clip there from 1945's rather romantic Brief Encounter, and a prime example of gradable adverbs, words added to understate the meaning of the phrase. Now, there's a report out today saying that they're endangered, that they're kind of falling out of use. Do you use any of these words when you looked through the list, Terry?
I'm somewhat distressed by this. I find it rather upsetting. Yeah, I think it would be... I'm going to do it all the time now. You know, I just want to stop me. I do think it would be very sad if you lose the kind of the art of the great British understatement. A great book, I don't know if you ever read the book called How to Be an Alien, which was published in the 1950s by a Hungarian emigre to Britain. He was explaining everything from tea to, you know, how Britain works generally. And he said the English have no soul, they have the understatement instead. And sort of went on to list all these kind of, you know, what people meant by saying, you know, I'm rather upset, or I'm, you know, somewhat perturbed. And, you know, I think that's it's part of the English language, and it's part of the British character. So I think if that were to go, I'd be, yeah.
Alessio is an Italian by birth, but someone who knows everything about the English language. Do you still get tripped up by people every now and then using these gradable adverbs and downplaying the meaning of what they're saying?
I actually like it. I think it's one of the things that really makes the English language so pleasant and to engage with, you know, how to develop a certain sort of nuances and sophistication and in a way hiding a far deeper reservoir of feelings and emotions. I think that's something also that, you know, as a foreigner here, when you then go to America where emotions are so in your face, you can see the difference. That's what the beauty of the language is all about, you know, seeing how differences allow you to express something that is just beyond the individual, but it makes your community all together. So I think it's a real shame if that's being lost. And again, as someone who started to learn English, not as a first language, that's definitely where, when you start seeing everybody, I remember when I was doing my master's here many years ago, everybody said, like, how are you? It's like, oh, yeah, it's all right. Actually, they never meant that. And there were so many other things. So that intrigues you and brings you into sort of trying to understand more. So it would be a very great shame.
Andrew Tuck, Terry Stiasny and Alessio Patalano talking about the death of the gradable adverb. For those of us who are not entirely aware of what that is, it's rather good, it's very interesting, and it's quite brilliant. Rather, quite, and awfully dying out. Well, that's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to all my guests tonight, to Alessio Patalano and to Terry Stiasny, also to Florence Biedemann and to Sean Kemp. From all of us on the Daily Team, goodbye, thanks for listening.